he respected my opinion, and therefore most of the things were done. I guess if you're saying, if you want to debate whether this was a set-piece battle or would not be a set-piece battle, I would have to say that that was not my decision. I don't know where that decision was made. Now, if you want to say how the battle was, set-piece battle was fought, then I think you've got a slightly different story.
Okay, would you, just one of the things that we're going to try to emphasize, we've been down to the Johnson Library, we've found footage, and so, you know, Lyndon Johnson went out, and the reserves were being sent out, and shook hands with every man going on board the planes, and very personally concerned with the troops going over during TAP, very concerned with the troops at Khe Sanh, and we're talking about there's coming in country, and so could you relate this anecdote? How are my boys up there in Khe Sanh?
Oh, well, President Johnson, as I, at the time that I was in Vietnam, the only relationship I had with President Johnson was that I knew his 2B son-in-law, Chuck Robb, now the, I guess he's Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. And so I knew very little about him until after Khe Sanh, but it certainly, I think, helped morale because somebody came up from McVee, and I can't remember who it was offhand, but they said, Dave, we want you to know that everybody's behind you. This was extremely important, at least, I think, with the people above me. And I'll say this for General Westmoreland, I'll say it for General Tompkins, I'll say it for anybody who was in my chain of command, including FMF PAC. Everybody seemed to think it was important that I wasn't forgotten. And so every chance they got, they'd fire me a dispatch. Hey, we know everything's going great. Keep it going. Everybody's proud of you. But on this same vein, somebody got off the helicopter and said, you know what the first thing that President Johnson said when he got off the plane? I said, I don't have the slightest damn idea. I'm up here. And he said, how are my boys at Khe Sanh doing? And, of course, that made everybody feel real good to think that he was thinking of us. I don't really think that anybody ever had any question that we had a priority. Just thinking of us. I don't really think that anybody ever had any question that we had a priority and that we were being looked after. I mean, the fact of the efforts that went into supplying us and the efforts that went in support to making sure we had all the fire support we had needed and everything. I don't think that really. I'd be surprised. You may be able to refute me by talking to other people who were there, privates and PFCs or something like that. But my feeling is that I don't honestly feel. I don't know that feeling went as far as the general public, but I do feel that everybody there knew that everybody in the chain of command was just breaking their backs to try to make sure we had everything we needed.
I only wouldn't refute you, I don't want to on that. We found a lot of evidence that Johnson was, you know, came very close to TAPs on and very concerned about the troops. One thing we wanted to ask you about, since it's, I don't think any of the reporters were aware of it at the time, nor could they have been informed, but you had a lot of electronic gear, a lot of intelligence data provided by sensors that gave you knowledge of enemy movement, troop movements, concentrations, and so on, that, as I said, a reporter coming out and said, he's not going to know that. You had a lot of knowledge of the enemy situation by virtue of this equipment. Could you say something about it and how you would coordinate such things as the arc-like bombings with it?
Well, I guess now it's getting to be fairly common knowledge. Of course, as you say, at the time it was classified. If I think that there were a number of things in that regard, I have always felt that, and I guess you're alluding to censors. I have always felt that censors and intimate knowledge of the terrain were very vital in defense of caisson. We had sensors which were implanted by the Air Force around the base, and although they sometimes were relaying in information by sounds other than what were there, nevertheless, they were a vital intelligence collection force. When you're sitting in a perimeter and you're fighting a battle and you've got something that can tell you out there. What I was relating to was that we had, boy, time doesn't fare me well because I don't, I guess it was Route 7. Anyway, it was...
Route 6 is the highway.
Route 6 is the highway? Well, it was Route 6. It ran from, Donghai, I guess, right from almost the coast and ran into Laos. Well, we had alluded earlier to the fact that we got this prisoner. And if I can deviate just a little bit and tie the sensor bit into that, I had taken this plan which this warrant officer had given to us, although not in writing, but what the interpreters had told me that he said. And I certainly wasn't going to buy it wholesale because I didn't want to get suckered. But I certainly looked for clues as to what he said was going to happen. I looked for him. So I had made up my mind to watch those. One of the things that he said was that sometime during it, they were going to come around, in other words, they were coming this way, which would be south, was that they were going to come around, come through Laos instead of, and of course, or normally they'd have gone down to the Eshowa Valley. Instead of going down there and going to the Eshowa Valley, they're coming in by Route 6 or whatever the route was, and come up that way. So we had indications that there was movement, and they had implanted sensors all along that route for us. And so early in the evening, sensors near the Laotian border, on our side, naturally, on our side, started going like crazy. And the next series went like crazy. And about that time, of course, the artillery people came in and said to me, my fire support coordination center said, Colonel, the sensors are going crazy there. I said, well, let's not be too eager, but let's start laying plans along that road where we want to get them. I would just soon hit them all along the road, but I want to make sure that I'm not wasting ammunition on something that we don't need. So the sensors started going, and they started building me a trail. And so I knew, as I said earlier in the interview with you, I had the very good fortune to be able early in my taking over the regiment to make a personal reconnaissance of all of the terrain around there. I had a pretty darn good idea where the assembly area was going to be. So I figured, hey, an attack's coming. And I said, there'll be one battalion's going to have an assembly area here, and there's another one going to have an assembly area here. So I said, okay, the minute they hit, when they get down to Quezon Village, there's a bridge down there, start pounding the bridge. There's they'll have trouble going around that, so we'll start there. Then I immediately made him a call to the general. Said, "General, I think tonight's the night. I think this is going to be an effort." He said, "Okay, what do you need?" I said, "I need a couple arc lights real quick, and I need them in these exact spots." And he said, "Let me talk to further up the line." So he talked to further up the line, and he come back and he said, "Dave, they've already left, and they don't want to change in the middle of that." I really don't care whether they left or not. Let's be a little bit flexible here and get them in. Well, to make a longer story short, they did, and little closer. I needed them a little bit closer than ordinarily you would bring them in, and this caused a little bit of consternation at the time. But anyway, the upshot was that I guess, and I'm guessing now because I don't really know, but I would guess that General Westmoreland interceded in our behalf and got us the arc lights where we wanted. I know from other intelligence that I am not prepared to say that that was going to be the main battle location. I am prepared to say that there were battalions in the area and that the timely strikes in those two particular areas, because of the classification of it, including the intelligence sources, why I know, I guess it's never really been completely told. Probably told in some classified tapes that might appear in the Marine Corps Museum or someplace. But I have always felt that night, and I can't give you the day, the week, the month, or anything else, but I always have felt that night was the key to the defense of Quezon. In other words, when we defeated that. And I think the most amazing part is that with the arc lights and with the artillery, including the 155s, the Army 155s, and my own artillery, and we mustered everything. We broke the back of what's happening. And now this, I don't know if the story has ever been told before, but and it's only one man's opinion. It would be interesting to talk to a North Vietnamese commander. If you ask Colonel Lowndes, Colonel Lowndes says that that was crucial. Because of the sensors, because of the inability for strategic, I don't know whether they call it strategic bombing or close level, but all I can tell you is that it was accurate as hell. When you told them this is where you wanted it, you never saw the plane, but it was where you wanted it. And it played a very crucial part, as far as I'm concerned, in the battle for Quezon.
Could you describe...
And I was going to add one more thing. That was, the fact of the matter is that the main defense, at least in my opinion, the main defense of Quezon was done without them ever closing to the wire, except maybe a point or two. In other words, the first elements might have closed the wire, but nobody else got in because of the effectiveness of supporting arms.
I'm just curious.
Good.
And we just got two more questions, maybe, and that's it.
He's run out of tape. I'm going to have to start tomorrow again. I need a match again, Tiger.
I'm out of match.
Oh. Hey, Mars!
Tremendous amount of firepower available to me.
You all ready, Tiger?
Ready to go?
I'm all set.
Let's go.
Okay, two more questions only, if I may. You may not want to respond to this since you have, in a way, discussed it. Are there any anecdotes that, you look back at Quezon, any anecdotes or special moments which kind of sum the whole experience up for you as a commander?
I don't really, I mean, to me the whole thing was just a tremendous job by unit leaders and I'm not talking about battalion commanders or regimental commanders. I'm talking about squad leaders and fire team leaders and lieutenants. Tremendous job by those people in maintaining a morale and an unfaltering belief in their capabilities, and never really wavering to any influence that that might be waved in front of them as to the fact that, hey, you may not be here tomorrow. I don't know that there's an anecdote that sums it up. I just think it's a tremendous amount of pride that I have in those people who were there, who did their job and did it very quietly among the hoopla, and weren't overcome by any reports they might get from home or anywhere else.
A lot of the troopers we spoke to said they felt they were writing a new chapter in Marine Corps history. Did you have that feeling? This was going to be a new chapter along with Okinawa and other major moments in the Marine Corps history.
Well, I guess I'd have to lie to say that I did. No, I don't think I honestly felt that way. Maybe when I come out and everybody told me it, they almost made me believe it. And as I say, I think perhaps the trooper did write a history, and if I can go back against, and I guess I've said it 10 times during this interview, but if I can go back again, you ask a group of people to do something was completely alien to their nature, and they accepted the challenge like that. They took the challenge, they did it, and they ran away with it. Who else? Think back. You were a Marine. Think back on your Marine Corps history. Who else was asked to, you stay there and let them shoot at you, and when the time comes, you'll clean their clocks? And they did. And never wavered, you know? And I guess it is a chapter. Come to it, damn it, it is. They did a good job, and I guess they deserve to be put down for having done it for that way. We've always been able to go forward and take our casualties and get our objectives, but nobody'd ask them to sit and take it, which they did, without losing the morale, which is important. So easy to lose morale. That's where you lose the battle. Once you get people doubting their capabilities, then you're... But I never felt that there was any doubt in their capabilities at all.
Let me ask you a final question. I asked you, had you seen the current films about Vietnam? You said no, I hadn't seen film in 70 years.
How many, 70? Well, no, it's been, I can tell you, it was, the last film I saw was probably aboard ship coming home from World War II. And I haven't been to the movies yet.
Why not? Why don't you like war movies?
I don't like any movies. I ain't seen any movie, never mind a war movie.
You haven't even seen the one that you made. Huh?
No, never looked at the one. I got, as you probably know, I got 2 copies of 2 different ones. There was one made in California. I never seen that one. And then there was another one about the Presidential Unit Citation. I never seen that. If I wasn't in them, I might look at them, but after people see this, they'll be through anyway, so it don't make much difference.
Let me ask you the final question. I asked you if you'd read any of the books, like Hurry's Dispatches, which, by the way, I recommend to you, it's excellent. And you said the following, it's over, they did their job. I know what went on. If the historians want to talk about it, it's up to them. Maybe you could say, why aren't you reading all these books about Vietnam and Khe Sanh and so on at this point in your career?
At this point in my career, I'm retired. You don't... Years and years ago, I was in Camp Lejeune, and I was assistant G3 of the 2nd Marine Division. And a Time reporter, a very famous one, and he couldn't have been that famous because I don't even remember his name, but I know that he was famous. He said, I'd like to talk to you alone at night. You seem... I had briefed him the day before on an exercise of what's going on. And he said, I'd like to talk to you tonight. And I said, fine. He said, I'll submit it to the Marine Corps if you're, you know, if you don't want, if you're afraid you'll say something, you shouldn't say something. No, the Marine Corps don't censor anybody. Go ahead. So he came to my room, and he said, among other things, he said, I am at this point in life, this is, God, this must be even before Korea. He said, I am, for writing purposes, willing to concede that Marines are the greatest in the world. Well, of course, that made him very popular with me to start with. He said, but I want you to tell me why. And you know, that's hard to put your hand on. And my story will end right here, so I don't take up too much time. But I said to him, I guess if I had to sum it, he said, why are Marines the greatest, and why do you want to lead Marines? And I said, well, I said, I think the thing that really gets to me most is that I never have to look behind me. And he said, well, that's a strange thing. And I look at it, and I guess like a Marine, I get sentimental, but I said that I always knew that Caudill and Santafani, who were in my first platoon, and ASAP and Gamindi and Forthrop, and I can name you the whole 43 of them if you want, but I won't, that they'd always be behind me. In any unit I led in my career, I felt that they'd always be behind me. The same thing was true at Quezon. I feel at Quezon I had the 6,000 or 7,000 people behind me. I never had to look to see whether they were there. I knew they were there. They were there. My career is over. I don't care what anybody says about those 6,000 people. I don't have to defend them. They don't need me to defend them. Their actions, what they did is there, and anybody who wanted to inspect, anybody that wants to make anything out of it that wasn't there, I could care less. I don't have to apologize for a single man. And what do I want to see all this stuff for? It means nothing to me. If I were going to do something like read something, I'd rather read about something Marines are going to do in the future. You never look back. You never look back. It's there. And you know it's there. And you know that it should be there, and if you know it should be there, it'll be there. And so, I don't know. I'm crazy, I guess, but that's the way I feel. I just feel that way. I don't... My wife says to me, but supposing somebody wants it for posterity? There ain't no posterity. As an individual, there's no posterity. I just was a very, very lucky man to have 6,000 great people. And without them, it would have been nothing. Dave Lowndes, what could he do? Nothing. Well, let's face it, what could he do? Nothing. Those kids did it. And maybe I'm afraid. Maybe I'm afraid that somebody will say something and it'll upset me. So I don't read anything about it. I know what was there. I know what those kids did, and I ain't going to worry about it. So I don't read any of it.
Well, this has been a marvelous experience for me. And believe me, a tremendous interview. Did we leave anything out?
I don't know. I didn't say what I said yet.
Well,
probably said we got to cut 99% of it.
I don't know, is there anything that, you know, we've talked about so many different things that somehow we didn't ask?
The only thing there was one sentence in here that I thought might tie into your story. No, not there. Right there.
you want to read that, if you would?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Want me to shoot my big mouth off a little bit more about it?
I would enjoy your shooting your big mouth off. I must say that your feeling about the troops, you know, looking down from where you were, they felt the same way looking up the chain of command toward their platoon commanders, battalion commanders, and toward you as a regimental commander. I know because I've interviewed them.
Well, you know, I, as you and I had discussed, I received this, and it was in a British Army Review, and it was written by a British major, and it deals with battle case on it, and it appeared there in December of 78, so it was about 10 years after the actual battle itself, and you hear these basically were his words, and I don't know that they're true. As we've gone through this interview, we've kind of alluded to the fact of what was the feeling at home. So this doesn't necessarily affect my views. But I thought it was interesting because let me just read you one paragraph. The last part is what we've been talking about, but let me read you the first part. The real heroes of Khe Sanh, however, were the junior officers and men of the garrison from the United States Marine Corps, the Army, and the Air Force. I think I've said enough during the last few minutes about that. They withstood 70 days of total isolation and the constant fire from NVA artillery, rockets, mortars, and small arms. And I think if I could just go a little bit further on that, two or three times during this interview, I've alluded to the fact that they were doing something alien to them. And I think the fact that it's alien is exemplified. You know, it's one thing. I was always taught anyway, don't get just by older and wiser men, leaders than myself, don't get yourself in a hole. Because if you get in a hole, you find it hard as hell to get out. And that's a natural. What's one of the first laws of self-preservation? Is look out for yourself. But we asked these guys to sit most of this time, which they did, and they took it. And then we get into the part that we were just discussing and say the newspaper and TV men were clearly looking for desperation and loss of confidence and morale, but they never found it. And then if you want to, this British officer goes a bit further, and I don't know that it played as an important part, but it must have had a point in morale because he thought it important enough to include it in his article. He says, the habit of I Company, which was Captain Dabney's outfit, on Hill 881 South, of raising stars and stripes every day may appear quaint and old-fashioned, but it shows a spirit which is very hard to quench. And maybe that sums it all up. Maybe that kind of just caps it. He goes on to say another lot of other nice things about the people that were at Khe Sanh, but the looking for desperation and loss of confidence and morale, but never found it. The fact that he would say it, he wasn't there, and he had no reason to. And he says it in retrospect, which is even more important. Because he's had a chance, obviously, I gather, he's all had a chance to review records and stuff like that.
Could you describe that morning ritual that Dabney's company had with the flag? I've got a picture of the flag itself.
I got a picture on the back of a C-ration box that the corpsman on Hill 81 drew me. It's in the garage out there, you know? I keep it in my private workshop.
Can you describe what happened?
Oh, well, of course, every morning, that got to be quite a thing, you know. Even in the country here, every morning they held colors. They literally held colors on the hill. It wouldn't make any difference whether there was firing going on or anything. The colors went up. At night, colors came down, and they had their, just like you would on a base in the United States. Then we started receiving flags from all over the United States, in which people said, we'd like to have you raise our flag on your hill. And we'd get it up to old Dabney, and he'd run it up for him, run it down again. So I guess in the country there must be some flags that old Captain Dabney's run up and down the pole a couple of times. And in that regard, I guess I'd be remiss in saying that I don't know how many hundreds of letters that I received personally, particularly from school children, saying they were saying prayers, and Colonel Lowndes, can anything we can do to help you, you can pass out these letters to the guys in the units and let them see them. And I'll give you one last anecdote, and then I'll get off, and I won't bother you no more. I came back as part of my public speaking tour, and I was in Plantation, Florida. They had a day for me down there. I don't know why. I must have had a friend down there or something. Anyway, they had a day for me, and I went in, and they had a parade, and then they had a reception. I guess the only people in the parade were my family. Everybody else stayed home, I guess. But anyway, all of a sudden, a priest came next door, and he said, Colonel Lowndes, we have a high school graduating class next door, and we'd like very much for them just to see you. You don't have to say anything. I said, well, first of all, Father, I'm Protestant. He said, I don't care about that. Secondly, I don't have nothing to say to the high school kids in the graduating class. And he said, I assure you, Colonel, you don't have to say a word. So I said, fine, I'll be more than pleased to, Father. I'll come over and I'll stand in front of the class. And you can introduce me, it'll embarrass me, but I'm willing to do it. So I did. I went over, and the good father, I'm sure, in his enthusiasm, if nothing else, said, and now Colonel Lowndes will say a few words to you. Well, of course, they have classes in college where you have to go in and do this, and they ask you to talk about a purple cow or something, but when you're stuck in front of a graduating class of a couple hundred with 300 or 400 parents there, and you haven't even thought about what you can say. So I started off this way. I said, it's indeed a pleasure for me to come here. I said, I don't know that the violence normally associated with the military is particularly at home, but I do want you to know one thing. I said, I'm probably the only Protestant in the world that carried 6 or 8 Catholic religious medals on him during a battle. And I said, you're going to kind of look at me funny and wondered why I carried 6 or 8. One wasn't good enough. And I said, I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that I received these medals from all over the world for people wishing me well and wishing for my safe exit from Quezon. And I said, I wasn't quite sure which one would work, so I always carried all of them. Thank you very much, and sat down.
That's fine, Father.
That was an excellent interview.
Yeah, superb. And a real, if I may say so, a personal privilege. I know that you have not shared these reflections with cameras or electronic stuff before, and I feel privileged that you did so with us.
Well, okay.
And I guarantee you we will use it for the benefit of the Corps and...
I'm not worried about it. I wouldn't be here if I didn't think you were.
I'd love to see that C-ration box, if I may say so.
Sure.
I'd like Clark, if he could, to
I'll bring
take
it up.
A picture of
I'll
it.
Bring it up.
Yeah.
I guess.
And any, oh, we both got our mics on.
Okay. Everybody forgets about those. They all get up and we'll try to leave with them still on.
This guy, incidentally, he says what you alluded to in here, too, about quite a plethora of advice and inference from his experience. I guess the reason that I don't